From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on January 19th, 2006, when NASA launched an interplanetary probe called New Horizons. The spacecraft was launched to study Pluto, its moons, and the Kuiper Belt. On this coming Tuesday, 9 years, 5 months, and 25 days after launch, the New Horizons probe will finally make its flyby of Pluto, up close, just a few thousand miles above Pluto's surface. Already we are seeing remarkable things. Turns out Pluto is a red planet. This hour we'll learn about what that means. My guest is Brian Koberlein, a senior lecturer at RIT for physics and astronomy. Now, Brian has just returned from a 10-day trip to the one place on our planet that is best suited to look deeply into space, the country of Chile. We'll find out why that is in a moment. Koberlein was selected for the National Science Foundation's Astronomy in Chile Educator Ambassadors Program. They traveled the country seeing telescope sites in the Chilean mountains. There were amazing highs and, as we'll find out in a few minutes, one giant letdown, but that's part of the process. So we'll talk about Pluto coming up and this important scientific moment. We start, though, with a conversation about how Brian got the chance to visit astronomy's holy grail. Brian Koberlein, welcome back to Connections. What was the impetus for this? Take us back a little bit and how you were chosen among, what, nine?
Nine people, yeah.
How did this happen?
Well, this was something that was called the Astronomy in Chile Education Ambassadors Program. And it's ASEP is what they typically call it. But the idea was to bring nine science communicators and educators down to Chile to see Chilean astronomy, to see what we're doing there, to see the culture, and to communicate back to the American public what's going on there and why NSF is investing money there and why we do astronomy there.
And if I recall correctly, some of the best places to look into the cosmos on our planet are in Chile?
Yes. Yeah, there's basically two of the top tier places. One is on Mauna Kea in Hawaii, and the other one is in the desert region of Chile.
Okay, and why Chile? What makes the region such a great place to look into the cosmos?
Well, it's got a combination of several things. One is it's on the edge of the Pacific, and so the Pacific winds come in over Chile. And Chile is this very narrow country smack up against the Andes Mountains. And so this steady wind comes in and then goes over the Andes Mountains, and that's when you lose the water vapor. So the region of Chile where they do the astronomy is both dry, has unturbulent skies, so it's very stable atmosphere skies, and it also has lots of places of high elevation. So all of those combined makes for a kind of sweet spot for modern astronomy.
Had you been there before?
I've never been south of the equator before.
Okay. And for someone like you, someone who you've been on this program many times, you're a senior lecturer on the subject, you're really one of the great science communicators that I know. This is the first time going to what's a pretty special place. I mean, do you still have any sort of a childlike wonder when you go out to a place like that?
I do, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to do was see the southern sky, you know, just on a personal level. And it's one of those things where you have to be careful what you wish for, because of the skies there are incredibly dark, and particularly where we are, we were in the mountain regions. A lot of people would talk about the ideal dark skies. To me, it was extremely bright skies. The night sky was so dark that you could see incredible details. The bright stars didn't seem to twinkle because everything was so clear. The Milky Way was so bright it almost seemed to cast shadows. It was an amazing thing to see that level of dark skies in the Southern Hemisphere.
For those of us who have seen a beautiful starry night, whatever location, I think of myself maybe down in the Finger Lakes, maybe a little bit less obstructed by modernity. Can it prepare you for looking at the sky as beautifully unobstructed as you get in Chile?
No. I've been in dark skies in the States, and this is... it's a very different experience. It's much darker. And we were, in fact, you know, I mean, we were not near the industrial areas, so that we were up near the observatories, which is extraordinarily dark skies to begin with. And so, you know, that type of experience, there may be a few places on the Earth where you would see that dark and that clear. But if you ever get the opportunity, I highly recommend it.
But you say dark skies. It's really bright from the rest of the from the cosmos, right? I mean, dark, but why do you say dark skies?
Well, dark skies are clear skies is what you want to say. But a lot of times when we see dark skies, we're talking about being relatively free from light pollution from the cities. Mm-hmm. And so if you go into a fairly remote area in the southern tier, for example, you'll see a dark sky. You'll see the Milky Way. But it is still... there's still some light pollution, and there's also a lot more water vapor in the air that you would see, and that you don't have in the regions of Chile where we were seeing the stars. So they're remarkably clearer, and because they were at 8,000 to 10,000 feet elevation, you had much less atmosphere between you and the stars. So it really was a very different thing. I've seen a lot of dark skies, but I've never seen skies that clear.
Okay. And did you say that they don't twinkle? Is that...
They almost didn't seem to twinkle, yeah, because the air is so stable that you don't notice the flickering as much. And so, you know, it almost seems surreal. It's almost like a painting or a photograph.
So what was the mission overall? Give me a sense for what you come back from these 10 days with now.
What we come back with is a much better understanding of how astronomy is done in Chile, what our goals are in terms of optical and radio astronomy, and a behind-the-scenes look at how modern astronomy is done on a big scale. And so, you know, we have that kind of firsthand experience of what's being done. And it's very different from what most people think of as astronomy.
How different?
Well, I think when most people think of astronomy, they think of some guy standing, you know, behind an eyepiece looking up at this large telescope to try and see something. And that's not really how it's done now, because we have digital sensors and we have large telescope arrays. And it's done in a very different way. You don't look at an eyepiece in a modern astronomy because that doesn't help. What you need is the digital information. And it's much more like using photography, digital photography, than it is, you know, what we would imagine as amateur astronomy of looking through a telescope.
All right. So take me through then some of the trip then. 10 days.
10 days.
In a moment, we'll talk a little bit about the one disappointment.
Yeah.
But most of the time you mentioned 8,000 to 10,000 feet in elevation. So we're talking almost 2 miles above sea level.
Yeah.
And that's up there to begin with, isn't it? I mean, are there concerns just about thinness of the air, breathing?
There are some concerns, and you have to watch out for some things like altitude sickness. Part of the idea was that our agenda was planned so that we went to increasing elevations. So when we came into Santiago, we spent time there, and then we went to mid-level elevations, the idea going eventually to higher and higher elevations. And so that helps with getting acclimated to the altitude.
And what are you doing? Can you give us a little sense for the itinerary?
Yeah, we came into Santiago and spent some time looking at what are known as tourist observatories. One of the things that's I think is very different in Chile than it is in the United States, and admittedly, I have a very narrow view of Chile and Chilean culture, and so I was very much shepherded, and it was only 10 days. But one of the things you'll see is there are a lot of tourist observatories. Because Chile has dark skies, there's kind of a recognition that that's important. It's part of the national heritage. And so you will see things like tourist observatories. And these are, you know, in the region of Santiago or La Serena, and you can go into fairly dark skies and see not only the night sky, but have an experience of the Chilean culture. So a lot of it is integrating Chilean culture and traditions with astronomy and star viewing.
When you're seeing, by the way, some of those dark skies near Santiago, there still must be some light pollution, right? Just not as severe as we're used to, or what?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Santiago is kind of bounded by mountains. And so if you go not too far, you're already in the mountain range, and you're outside of the industrial areas. So just because of its geography, it tends to be fairly compact. And so you don't have to travel too far to get to what are pretty decent dark skies. I mean, the type of thing we would see, you know, around the Finger Lakes or something.
Okay. And you're working your kind of way up in elevation, is that right?
We're working somewhat up in elevation and then seeing some of the major telescopes that were along the way.
for an amateur like me, I think, well, you must be privy to the greatest technology in the world here. It's, you know, and different story there. What was it like?
They're on a very different ballgame. Of some of the telescopes that we saw, one of them was known as Gemini South, and this is an 8-meter telescope. So, you know, it's about 25. The mirror itself is about 25 feet across. So this thing is huge. It's as big as a room. That's just the mirror. So you have this, you know, large dome. You have this huge mirror that reflects the light into these, you know, $100 million, $50 million sensors that digitally capture the light. And these things are a huge collaborative project. I mean, there's hundreds of people that work on these telescopes at any given time. And that's one of the newer ones. Another one where we actually spent 2 days was at Cerro Tololo, Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory. And that is a 4-meter telescope, a Blanco telescope. And even that one is huge. I mean, 4 meters is a huge thing. It's 12, 13 feet or something. And it's hard to get that sense of scale. You know, these things are multi-story buildings. They're huge domes, and they have huge telescopes. They're all run by computers and high-definition digital cameras that are sensing all of these things, and you're collecting, you know, tons of data every night.
What exactly are they looking for?
It depends on the mission. Mm-hmm. So Cerro Tololo, for example, is looking at supernovae. So you look at distant supernova, and you can determine kind of the evolution of the universe. So you've heard of dark energy, for example, this cosmic thing that is causing the universe to expand. Well, one of the things we want to do is kind of pin down the nature of that dark energy. Is it a constant force? Does it change over time? You know, does it vary from direction to direction? And the way we have to do that is to measure the distance of distant objects. And by doing that, we can look at supernova explosions. So we look at stars that explode, a particular type of stars called type 1A, and we can use that to calculate how far away they are. We can then measure how fast they're moving by something known as Doppler redshift. So we can see how far those galaxies are moving, how fast they're receding away from us. And by using that, we can kind of map out how dark energy changes over time.
And again, we've talked about this on the program before, but I think it still bears asking. Dark energy, it's not something that's perfectly settled. I know there's some disagreement on whether it exists at all, and where are you in this debate?
Well, there's two things. There's dark matter
dark
matter and dark energy.
Correcting the host. So now let's go ahead and define. You've been saying dark energy.
I've been saying dark energy, okay. Yeah, in this case. Dark matter is matter that we can see its gravitational effects in things like galaxies and galaxy clusters. And it is something that appears to be matter in nature but doesn't interact with light. And so we can't see it directly. We can only see it by its gravitational effects. And there's a lot of studies being done on that. Dark energy is a cosmic energy that causes the universe to expand at an ever-increasing rate. So when we look at galaxies, the more distant the galaxy, the greater their redshift, the faster they appear to be moving away from us. And by looking at that, we know that the universe is expanding. Now, it could have been that the universe was expanding just because, you know, the Big Bang caused everything to fling out, and then it's just expanding that way. But that's not what we're seeing. What we're actually seeing is not only are the galaxies expanding, but over time, we see them expanding at an ever-increasing rate. And so something is driving that acceleration. Something is causing the universe to continually expand at an ever-increasing rate. And that's pretty solid evidentially. I mean, we know by evidence that's what's happening. What we don't know is anything about what is dark energy.
Are we learning? I mean, how much progress are we making on understanding it?
Well, we're learning. We've eliminated some of the models. So there's basically whenever you have some wild thing that we see in physics or astronomy, the theorists love this, and they come up with hundreds of different ideas. And each of them have different predictions about what may or may not occur. And so we haven't been able to pin down what dark energy is, but we can eliminate some of the alternatives. So kind of two of the big ones are something called the cosmological constant. This is something that Einstein originally introduced as a mistake to try and keep the universe stable. And then when he found out that it was expanding, he said it was his greatest blunder. And that would be that just a structure of space and time is inherent to what the universe is that causes this expansion. It's just in the same way that we have length, width, and time, we have a cosmological constant. Another idea would be some type of energy or force, like quintessence, for example, the fifth force that might cause things to expand. And what we see from the evidence is that it points more strongly to the cosmological constant than it does to quintessence.
Talking to Brian Koberline, recently back from Chile, 10 days in Chile, June 20th through the 30th. He is an RIT senior lecturer of physics and astronomy and was chosen as an Astronomy in Chile educator ambassador, one of nine for this trip. And so we're hearing about what some of these really remarkable pieces of technology can do. How much time did you have with them? I mean, was this more of a quick observation, or did you do any actual extended work at all?
It depended on the area. So okay. Something like Gemini, we had kind of a quick tour of Gemini and SOAR, and then we were shuttled on our way to CTIO. Mm-hmm. CTIO was nice because we got to spend two nights there. So we really got to walk around and experience it. And it's more than just one observatory. It's not just one telescope. There are actually, on the top summit, there are several large telescopes, the largest being the Blanco. But then slightly down a little bit are what they call the Mushroom Village, that are smaller 1 and 2 meter telescopes, including some from Google, which have some automated telescopes there. And so we got to be actually see all of these, see some of them working, watch the sunset from the area, which was amazing, and get kind of that experience there.
Forgive my ignorance, but they get some cloud cover and rain at some point, don't they?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it isn't 100% clear nights, but they are kind of like the opposite of us. The number of sunny days we get, they get cloudy days.
Interesting. So if you're wondering why Chile again, if you missed that earlier part of the discussion, they have... fascinating to me to hear Brian say it's even part of their cultural appreciation as a people that this is part of what they are, that they offer some of the clearest look at our skies anywhere on the planet. And so despite all of that, despite these remarkable pieces of technology, the telescopes they have, this clear-eyed look into the cosmos, for those of you who have heard us talk on this program in recent months about Fermi's paradox. Where is everybody? Not even in Chile have they found any evidence of that, which is, if you were going to find it anywhere on this planet, it might be Chile.
Right.
But still nothing that would make you say, I wonder what that is. I suspect if we ever make any great discoveries, though, it may be from Chile.
Yeah, it's interesting. If I remember the statistics right, in the next 20 years, 2/3 of major astronomy will be done in Chile.
Wow.
So it is the point one. It's the zero point of where astronomy is going to be done.
And so as you continue on your 10-day journey, the one disappointment was a chance to go up to some of the group. You had to pass sort of a, I don't want to call it a fitness exam. It was more just a because Brian wrote
on
his
fitness check.
Okay, yeah. All right. Well, Brian wrote on his blog, the name of the blog is?
One Universe at a Time.
One Universe at a Time. And Brian wrote on his blog about this experience that a perfectly fit marathon runner might not have the fitness to go up to 16,000 plus feet, and someone who looks like they couldn't run a mile might. And so tell us about what happened that day, where you were going, and what happened with you.
Okay. Well, the idea was to go to what's called the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, or ALMA, as it's known. And this is a large radio telescope array. So if you look at your satellite dishes, for example, imagine 60 of these 12 meters wide and another dozen that are 7 meters wide. And they're all spread out over this flat plane trying to gather information, gather radio information. The difference is that this thing is at 5,000 meters, which is about 16,400 feet. And so the way ALMA is set up is you've got kind of the main control area, which is at about 10,000 feet. And it's at kind of the base of this mountain region going to the plateau. And then you have the plateau itself at 16,400 feet. They have open tours where you can go to the low site and you can see the control room and you can see some of the dishes that they're repairing and get kind of a tour of that. But the real thing that everybody wants to see is the high site, where all these telescopes are, or all these antenna are. And so in order to do that, you have to spend at least one night at elevation. So you have to spend it one night at ALMA, or in the surrounding region, at about 8,000 to 10,000 feet. And then you have to go through a health check. And the health check looks at your oxygen levels, your blood pressure levels, see if you have any signs of altitude sickness or anything like that. And they give you an up or down approval. And so if you get the up approval, then you can get the tour to go to the high site and actually see these large telescopes. Within the group, I didn't get the approval. So for whatever reason, my blood pressure reading was too high for them to approve me.
You posted a sad face picture on the blog.
Yeah, that was a sad face because it was the one that wouldn't give me the outraged face. But, you know, it's one of those things. You meet with very mixed emotions because it's one of those things that you really want to see. It's the highest observatory on the planet, and it is the cutting edge of where radio astronomy is being done. So it'd be a really cool thing to see this, and I didn't get approved. You know, I try and take a learning experience from it in the sense that it was kind of interesting that when I didn't get approved, the rest of the crew did. When they went up, they made a little video saying that they missed me, and then several of them brought back little rocks from the place. It's like, okay, well, you almost made it. So, you know, I did get that.
But three miles up, three plus miles, that is legitimately dangerous.
It's legitimately
You didn't
dangerous.
Question their decision.
You're of two minds. On the one hand, you're emotional going, I will go there. But from the logical standpoint, you know that I'm just fine is the type of thing that can get you killed. It's at an elevation where 40% of the atmosphere is below you. So you are seriously up there. People have done things where they've taken, for example, an empty water bottle, and they'll cap it. And when they bring it back down to sea level, it's just crunched. So it's that much of a difference. You could have a brain hemorrhage. You could have a stroke. You could have a lung collapse. You know, this is serious business, and there's a reason why they do the health check there.
So that was your one disappointment from the trip.
Yeah.
But overall, the sense of it, you come back now, and you're somebody who I think you're known for communicating science effectively, not just to other scientists, but to people like myself and to our audience and so many others and your students. What does this allow you to do now? What did this experience allow you to come back with even better armed to communicate about science?
Well, I think one of the things that I noticed is that when you get behind the scenes and you kind of see how astronomy is done on a large scale, you get a very good sense of how it is a collaborative effort. You know, it is not something that individuals do. It is something that groups do, that communities do, that nations do. It is a human endeavor when we engage in large astronomy. And you can see this over and over again. ALMA, for example, is not dictated by the United States, for example. One of the impressions that people got was it's much more like the UN. Because ALMA $1.4 billion project. And so it's a collaboration between the United States, Europe, East Asia, and Chile. And the organization that manages ALMA is much more like the UN. No one can dominate everything. They have to work collaboratively. They have to organize collaboratively. And that's the direction that modern science is going. You know, we're doing international collaborations. We're doing it as a human species and not as individuals and not as individual countries.
In many ways, it seems that we and the world community is fortunate that Chile, as a nation, is so welcoming, I would think, to the scientific community worldwide to come in, to use the space, or am I wrong about that?
No, that's something that Chile actually prides themselves on in terms of the friendliness and welcoming aspect of their culture. And it really does have a lot of advantages, both culturally and politically. You know, in the sense that it's a strong economy, it's a stable government, it has perfect skies for what we want to do, and it's an active participant in international relations. So we have kind of all the makings that we need to do real astronomy there on the long term.
How's your Spanish?
awful.
You take a crash course for this?
I took a little bit of a crash course. You know, you learn things like baño for a bathroom really quickly. And, you know, it's surprising how well, you know, the old joke of someone who speaks two languages is bilingual and someone who speaks one language is an American, you know. and as a clearly American from the language standpoint, you can navigate actually extraordinarily well. You know, there is a lot of solid English speaking within Chile. And even in the regions where you don't have a lot of English understanding, you can get by pretty well. You know, they're very accommodating there.
They are proud of their wines as well.
They are proud of their wines.
And you got a chance to taste some of their wines?
Yes. Yes. They have very, very good wines. And one of the people who was in charge of it is very much a wine aficionado. So I got a very healthy taste of Chilean wines across the region.
And you also said, what was the other, either bit of cuisine or another drink that they had that sort of?
It's kind of like the national drink. It's called a pisco sour.
Pisco sour. Tell me about a pisco sour.
And it's pisco is, I think, similar to brandy. It's a fermented and distilled thing. And it's combined with lemon juice and some sugar and egg white. And sometimes you put in things like ginger or cinnamon or things like that. And it's one of the things that they pride themselves on. And, of course, when you go to Chile, you have to have pisco sours.
And how'd you like it?
They're very good. They're very good. It's kind of like a spiked lemonade, but with more texture to it. It's a more richness. It's not as flat as you might think hard lemonade is.
All right. So honest question then, because I think for our audience who likes the idea of experiencing new things and travel, et cetera. Is there a astronomical tourism industry there?
There is indeed astrotourism. It's a burgeoning area in there, and there are places that actually facilitate astrotourism. You can see both dark skies and amateur astronomy, and you can see some of the larger telescopes that have tours.
So, honestly, I think sometime in the future I could see myself going, making a couple of wine appointments, doing a little travel, seeing Santiago, and doing a little astrotourism, and that would be a legitimately stimulating trip.
I would recommend it to anyone who's interested in wine and astronomy.
But what is the flight to Santiago? Where are you flying from?
I actually flew from Rochester to Atlanta and then to Santiago.
And what's the flight to Atlanta to Santiago?
It's 10 hours. 10. Nine and a half hours. So
it is down there.
It's down there, but it's actually not that bad of a flight. I mean, the people complain about different flights, but the flight I had was actually quite fine.
All right, before I let Brian go, and again, Brian is a senior lecturer of astronomy and physics at RIT. We got to talk a little bit about Pluto, if you don't mind.
Uh-huh.
Because, first of all, Pluto's back in the news. Pluto's been in the news a lot in recent years. And I actually asked Brian before the interview began, I said, is it a planet again or is it not? And what did you say?
It is not officially a planet yet, although the opinion that it should be is rising.
And I said, what would you vote? What if you had a vote on this? You had a great response to this.
I don't have a problem with Pluto not being a planet. I know that kind of puts me on the dark side, but I think if we look at categorizing people, an 8-year-old is not an adult, and they're very different. And even though you know adults and 8-year-olds are all human, they're very different in terms of their characteristics and behavior. Pluto is very different from the traditional planets. It's smaller than our moon, and if it were closer to the sun, it would look more like a comet. You know, it's very different from what we see as the traditional planets.
What's going on there now? Or what's about to go on there?
What's about to go on there is we're having the flyby of New Horizons. So we're going to have the close encounter of Pluto. Already we're getting some incredible pictures of, you know, it's very clear that Pluto is a red planet. And that's because of the organics that are on its surface. And we've kind of known that for a while, but now the pictures can't deny it, which is interesting.
I think I understand, but I want you to explain a little bit more about what it means to be a red planet.
Well, there's normally Pluto would be seen as, we would think of Pluto as being kind of an icy, whitish
yes.
blue planet.
Yep.
And the thing is, chemistry is complex in space. And so you can get chemical reactions, even in cold environments like Pluto, where you can have, you know, organic materials or complex molecules, and there are molecules on Pluto that give it a reddish tinge. And so we've known about this because we've done spectroscopy of Pluto, but now we have actual images that show this.
Whenever I see Pluto on a chart on the wall, it's always kind of a gray or a blue or a beige, and it may have to be red now.
It may have to be red now. Okay. Yeah, it's closer to Mars than it is to Ceres.
What is the schedule for the New Horizons then?
It will fly by next Tuesday.
How quick is the flyby?
I think a matter of hours. It's going pretty fast.
Okay. So, but we've already been getting really remarkable stuff on the way there, right?
Right. What's going to happen is we're going to get some pictures leading up to the close encounter, leading up to the flyby, and then it's going to go into its flyby. And then over the next, I think, 16 to 18 months, we're going to get data back. So because in order to get to Pluto in a reasonable time, you have to move fast. And that means that when it goes by Pluto, it's just going to zip right past. And so the devices, the sensors that are on the probe are actually designed to collect a whole bunch of data very quickly. And then it's going to hold it. And then once that flyby is done, it's going to have time to actually send it back bit by bit over a slow time. Because it's so far out there, it can't transmit a high rate of data.
I'm amazed it can transmit data at all.
But it's kind of amazing just that we can do this.
Yes, that this is another one of those moments where you say, we'd be hunting and gathering for 1,000 years if I had to repopulate the planet. So I'm thrilled there.
Pluto is now the big thing, but we have new observatories coming up. We've got a new satellite. Gaia is going to be coming online, and that's going to measure the position and trajectories of a billion stars in our Milky Way, which is, only 1% of what we can see. But, this is amazing to have this kind of level map. So it really is a transformative time. We're kind of in the golden age of astronomy.
Thanks for coming in, and we'll be reading your work online as well.
Okay, thank you.
Coming up in our second hour, where should we draw the line when it comes to comedy, especially when we're talking about race or generalizing about culture? Jerry Seinfeld, Amy Schumer, Bill Maher, and Chris Rock have all been in the news in the last week, talking about why they don't like to do college campuses. They say it's too PC, everyone is just looking to get offended. Are they right? Where should the line be? Our panel debates it, and we'll take your calls as well.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Village at Unity, independent senior living that supports an active, independent lifestyle, offering hospitality, personal transportation, and other amenities. The Village at Unity, like no other. For tours, call 723-7442.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My colleague Veronica Volk is in studio. And just about the entire newsroom today is working in some capacity on covering Governor Cuomo's Capital for a Day, which is happening right now in Rochester. And Veronica, first and foremost, I think a lot of people are wondering, what is Capital for a Day? You were saying during the break, this is the first one.
Yeah, actually, Rochester is home to the first Capital for a Day. The idea is you take the entire state cabinet and they spend the entire day in a city. Today, it's Rochester representing the Finger Lakes region. And Cuomo said this is an idea where local government is closest to the people, right, which has its advantages. And actually, I think we have a cut from him, so we can hear it right from him.
It is a very novel concept. It's something I did in the federal government where we take the entire cabinet from Albany, the commissioners who run the state government, and we spend the day in a city. This is the kickoff event in Rochester. And the concept is to make the relations, to find out on the ground exactly what needs to be done and how we can best help.
He also had this really great quote where he said, you're either picking up garbage and filling potholes or you're not. So I think that really sums it up. And the idea is, like I said, to bring these senior state officials to Rochester and then presumably to other cities to see, what's going on here in the Flower City and that they've heard so much about, but maybe actually haven't been here. And you have commissioners from the Department of Health, from the Department of Labor, the DOT, the DEC. So they're covering a lot. And there's actually 23 events today. We're only going to be able to cover a couple of them, but there's going to be roundtables, ribbon cuttings, other kinds of discussions and all that good stuff.
Whenever there is a political campaign, people will say, well, when's the last time so-and-so was actually in Rochester? This is a chance for, you say, the entire cabinet.
Right. And I think a lot of these ideas aren't going to be new to the people of Rochester and the people who are covering it in Rochester. But the idea is to expose maybe senior state officials that spend a lot of time in the Capitol to what's really going on down here, up here.
Here's the, I guess it is up here compared to them. Down here, up. Yeah, never know. Over here, whatever. this is a question that I'm not sure any of us can actually answer. But I think it is worth asking, which is, there are news releases that come out with this. We see them right now. I'm sorting through them. I see things that say photo ops. I mean, every time I see the term photo op, we covered this on the program last week, it feels staged. And the question is this an opportunity to shake hands and check some boxes, or are they doing real work? And it does sound like they're spending a long time actually meeting very specifically, trying to get actual work done. Best
right.
we can tell.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I don't think this is an answerable question from our side.
Sure.
But there are a lot of really important topics being covered today. We're going to be looking at anti-poverty initiatives, labor initiatives, getting people back to work. We're looking at environmental issues throughout the city, throughout the region, the Regional Economic Development Council. You know, like I said, we have commissioners from various levels of state government here to kind of like hear us out, hear what our local officials have to say, and hear from the people of Rochester as well.
And I know we've got our colleagues as well on the line with us. I think Brad Smith first up. Brad is covering one of the many. Veronica?
Yeah, Brad's over at the Finger Lakes Regional Economic Development Council meeting where the governor is, I believe.
Brad, are you there? Do we have him? I think the board says we have him. My ears do not. Maybe we don't have Brad.
I guess not. Well, I think that, you know, we've been hearing a lot about the Regional Economic Development Council and this $1.5 million.
Billion.
Billion.
That was a Dr. Evil moment where a $1.5 million.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for correcting me. So yeah, we've heard a lot about this Regional Economic Development Council, and we're still in the process of putting together proposals to have, you know, businesses and innovators in the area compete for this this great sum of money that could really be a game changer.
Yeah, a big pot of dollars that from the beginning, to Veronica's point about the $1.5 billion, there are seven, upstate essentially split into seven regions. Three will be awarded pots of $500 million. Everyone was assuming from the outset that the Rochester Finger Lakes region is a shoo-in to win one of these things because there is so much, let's be honest, animosity about the fact that Buffalo got the ostensible Buffalo billion, and
right.
if Rochester ends up with nothing out of this, there's no way that's happening. But they still have to compete for it. They have to present proposals. How are you going to use this money? What kind of infrastructure does it build? What are the economic opportunities? So I'm sure that is part of what we're going to see today.
Absolutely. And there was a great moment this morning at the cabinet meeting because the events were kicked off this morning at a cabinet meeting where you had the governor addressing kind of why this is important. You know, and everyone going around kind of thanking everyone for being there. But, you know, County Executive Maggie Brooks had this great line where she said, "We're here in Rochester to kick off this awesome initiative and take that Buffalo," which I think, you know.
She said, "Take that Buffalo?"
Yeah, which encapsulates a lot of the feeling where people were really bitter about the Buffalo Billion.
It's so strange. I mean, I guess it's not strange. I mean, I understand the competition about upstate cities, but we're really hung up on it still.
Yeah, that's okay. This is an opportunity for us to kind of turn things around, maybe.
Boy, very interesting. Well, let me bring in Michelle Faust. I don't know what happened to Brad Smith. We'll send a search party. Michelle Faust, I think, is on the line with us. Michelle, are you there?
I am here.
Nice to see you, Michelle. And Veronica, you want to set the stage for us for where our colleague Michelle is?
Yeah, Michelle, I understand that you are at the Immigrant and Refugee Roundtable discussion.
That's right. I'm at the Ibero American Action League on Main Street. Ibero is known for a lot of the work that they do with a lot of immigrant communities, especially Latino immigrant communities. And here, Cesar Perales, the Secretary of State, is speaking on a panel with several other people, including Jorge Montalvo, who is from the Office of New Americans and Economic Opportunity. And really what the conversation is here, it's really more of a listening. They've got a panel and they're talking a little bit about what's happening here at the state level, but they're listening to people from all kinds of organizations that reach out to refugee and immigrant communities and provide services to them to what are the things that they need. And we've got people from the ag community, you know, different people in agriculture from all of the areas in the Finger Lakes, and they're talking about micro-lending and maybe how that could help some refugee and immigrant people who want to start businesses and have good ideas use some of their skills, how to get people trained in different things that are maybe a little bit different. They're talking about the Bhutanese community and how some of the refugees from Bhutan, some of them, you know, a lot of them, are coming from agricultural centers in their country, and that maybe they would be more comfortable working in agriculture and working in more of the rural areas than in the city centers when they come to Western New York. So many, many, many things and many topics coming up, but just all centered around how to help people settle and be successful when they come to Western New York from anywhere in the world.
Michelle, do you get the sense today that, and I'm sure from a government perspective, this is about what is happening and what can be done as opposed to what did not get done in the recent session? I'm referring to the DREAM Act, and I know there were a lot of people disappointed.
There was some comments about that. There were some people saying, you know, why don't we have some sort of a license that would help people who don't have documentation? This is something that exists in New York City but does not exist in the rest of the state. And there was comment about, well, you know, the governor may want to do that. Secretary of State Perales said exactly that. But he said, well, we have to have that to come through. And they said, you know, the governor is very much in support of the DREAM Act, but he's got to have buy-in from the complete legislature.
And it hasn't happened in the last two sessions, even though there has been more emphasis publicly than I have ever seen on it. If it failed in the last two, is there a sense from the people you talk to that they are becoming cynical, they think the DREAM Act isn't going to happen, or is there still a hope that you push it every session hoping it gets through?
Well, honestly, that was one of the topics that has come up from the audience, but not the center. Really, the conversation has centered on economic development. Of course, that has to include education at the college level, but they're more talking about job training for adults that are coming into the country. But yeah, the people in the group do seem to be, there was some groaning when they talked about the DREAM Act, but not a whole lot of discussion there.
I am also curious about healthcare and services for the Latino community, also the non-English speaking community. You have reported, Michelle, on one of the barriers for the ACA and our state exchange, for example. One of the barriers for some people in our community has simply been access to resources, help, especially if English is a second language or not a language that they currently can speak. How are we doing on that scale?
Well, there was lots of conversation. People who go to the Office of New Americans, one of the things that were mentioned, of course, this doesn't apply for the Affordable Care Act because you do have to be a resident or citizen to get any kind of ACA help with your health care. But that people who come to the Office of New Americans, they don't ask immigration status, so people can come in and work on their English, and other places that people can come and work on their English. But when it comes to that interpretation piece, that was one of the things that was mentioned, that there is not enough, there just are not enough people who are trained in all of the language for all the different immigrant communities. And that includes some of the people in the country illegally, because a lot of people who are coming from Central America, they're of indigenous backgrounds, and they may speak Spanish, but Spanish is often their second or third language, and a native language being their first primary and best spoken language.
Vamos a escuchar esta tarde, y gracias. Thank you very much, Michelle.
Thank you very much.
You know, you're very kind to laugh gently, and you'll come back to the office and probably correct me.
But I'll see you very soon.
Vamos a practicar. Thank you, Michelle. Michelle Faust reporting for us among one of the 23, you said, Veronica Volk, you said 23
yes,
different...
Yes, 23 events across the city today.
Okay, and so if you're just joining us, we're wrapping this hour by helping cover for you Governor Cuomo's Capital for a Day event that is happening in Rochester. The first Capital for a Day event is in Rochester. It is today, and then they're going to take this event to other cities around the state. And as Veronica mentioned, the entire cabinet is here holding these kind of events and trying to meet with various stakeholders. Brad Smith from WXXI is reporting on the economic side of things. And I think we've got you locked in now. How are you, Brad?
I'm good, Evan. How are you doing?
Very good. What are you seeing so far today?
I'm seeing most of that cabinet in action, sitting in a round table in one of the ballrooms over here at the convention center. The focus this time around was the economic development groups that are around the state. Rochester has an active one led by Danny Whiteman and Dr. Joel Seligman. We heard from them. We heard from the governor. We heard from the lieutenant governor, right on down the line, the mayor, the county executive. And you know what, Evan? I think the thing that I draw from this is they're all talking to each other. As much as we may not think so, they seem to have a good team put together.
Okay. And what can a mission be in a single day? I mean, I think, as Veronica said earlier, in many ways, the community will appreciate seeing people up close and getting face-to-face and handshake-to-handshake kind of meetings. But what can they expect to get done in a day?
Well, good question. I would offer you this example. When I was originally supposed to chat with you, that was exactly when the meeting broke up, so I ran back in. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
And there were people just, you know how you pull somebody aside and you make something happen, you work out a detail, you make an arrangement for another meeting or whatever. It was just happening all around that room. And it was a chance for a state senator to talk to a Danny Whiteman. It was a chance for, you know, other people in the crowd that were there as part of the mission. One is economic development, the other a sub-mission of that to fight poverty in our town in the unique way that we're trying to do that. Everybody had a chance to kind of get FaceTime. And like Veronica said earlier, you've got all the department heads here.
Well, Brad, before I let you go, I would just say that I'm sure Vinny Esposito's out there. Vinny is somebody who used to be in the Monroe County Legislature and now does economic work for the governor here in the Rochester Finger Lakes region. He is one of the really bright people that I know in this region, and he's one of those sort of behind-the-scenes guys. You don't often see him getting a lot of the credit. And Vinny said to me in recent weeks, he said, you know, when the Anti-Poverty Initiative got started and they brought in dozens of stakeholders, the first day everyone was a little bit cynical. They kind of thought photo op, you know, pose for the cameras. And they walked out that day going, I cannot believe what we got done. And this is actually serious. And it sounds like the tenor of what you're seeing today is similar.
I agree. I walked out with Vinny and talked with Joe Morelli. He had an interesting story, by the way, about that anti-poverty meeting. They made him an example during that meeting, and sometime you'll have to ask him about that. It was good.
We'll be looking for your reports this afternoon at WXXI. And thank you, Brad. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Evan.
Brad Smith from WXXI covering these events. So the governor's Capitol 4 day in Rochester, you're getting a sense for it. Veronica Volk, where do you go next?
I'm actually headed over to the Rochester Business Alliance about 2 o'clock. Over there, Mario Mussolino is the acting commissioner for the Department of Labor. He's going to be there with representatives from the Office of Children and Family Services, Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance, and the New York State Faith-Based Community Development. They're going to talk about public-private partnerships to end poverty. Obviously, not a secret that Rochester has a poverty problem. And it's also, you know, a cornerstone of Mayor Warren's, I guess, agenda, right? So the approach to this has been, in a lot of ways, just create more jobs. And this is one of the ways that people are looking at doing it. And this isn't a new idea. I think it might have been back in April when Bob Duffy made a push for members of RBA to hire people who are trying to escape poverty. This was a couple months ago. And, you know, at the time he said that, you know, RBA was going to be leading by example and hiring people who were trying to escape poverty themselves. And it's really trying to set up this partnership between community organizations who train individuals and, you know, a workforce that's in demand.
They know now, too, with this anti-poverty initiative and this work on economic development, that it's results time. And that's sort of a cliche, but there is so much emphasis on this, and there have been so many failed efforts in the past that it's legacy time. This governor will be remembered in a very positive way if you see Buffalo and then Rochester and other cities upstate bouncing back economically, and you see this anti-poverty initiative make a real dent. And he will be viewed, I think, in some negative light if these things stagnate. So it'll be fascinating for us to watch what's happening. Your coverage tonight? Things Considered and more?
You can hear more coverage from myself, Michelle, and Brad, all on All Things Considered. And to your point earlier, Evan, I think that when it comes to the RBA stuff, you know, we haven't really seen results yet, or at least I haven't heard of them. But I think that this is an opportunity for, you know, the RBA and other people working on anti-poverty initiatives to kind of give us more information about what has been happening and what results they have seen in the last couple months, because it's still, you know, it's still in many ways in infantile stages. So,
all right, Veronica, thank you. Doing great work for us today. In fact, the entire WXXI newsroom, and I say this, you know, these are the days I wish people could see the resources in action. And I mean that every day, but today we've been really, really moving to cover these events. So much more coverage on WXXINews.org, all things considered, and various newscasts throughout the day. And we'll see you and hear you then.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Short break, and we're coming back. We're going to try to laugh, but we're going to also ask ourselves, when should we not laugh and draw a line in comedy? That's next.